rabbit. You got a beautiful chin. You got beautiful skin. You got a beautiful face. You got taste.
Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. On this episode, we speak to a man who has spent over five decades writing and performing some of the most instantly recognisable music as part of the legendary London duo Chas and Dave. As well as releasing over 100 hit singles, our guest today began as a session musician for Jerry Lee Lewis and has since collaborated with the likes of Jules Holland and Hugh Laurie and had his own songs covered by the likes of Tom Jones and Tori Amos. Today we'll be finding out exactly how Chas composed classics such as Ain't No Pleasing You, how it came about Chas appeared on a hit single by Eminem, and how Chas fulfilled the dreams of none other than Carl Pilkington. It's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is the legendary Chas Hodges. Thanks for joining us today, Chas. How's it going?
Yeah, going very, very well, yeah.
Good, good, good. I believe you're back on the road soon. Is that right, again?
Yeah, well, I'm always on the road, well, always gigging anyway. I mean, that's part of my life. I've been gigging all my life for over 50 years now, and it's part of my what I do every week. So, me and Dave are gigging away as per usual.
Good stuff. And, I mean, you've obviously done thousands of gigs and hundreds of tours. I mean, how do you find the prospect of touring these days?
As I say, it's part of my life. If I don't do at least two or three gigs a week, I feel like I've lost a night's sleep or lost a day's food. It's part of my life. Nowadays, it's very easy. We got a nice motor car that we drive about in. In the old days, we used to have a rusty van back in the 60s that was quite often breaking down. No, so it's quite luxury nowadays, touring.
How do you keep it fresh for yourself, having toured so many times and played so many gigs? How do you keep it fresh?
Well, we're always, there's always, I mean, for instance, our normal theatre show is the first half. We do Chas and Dave in the 70s, and that changes all the time. And it's fun for us, and it's also fun for the audience, because we do stuff that me and Dave used to get together. We used to just drag songs out of the air in the 70s, before we'd written too much personal material. And we just make it our own, and we keep coming up with songs all the time. Say, yeah, remember we used to do them, Bones In, Dry Bones. I think, yeah, okay, we'll stick that one in. So there's always something fresh. We always do the hits. We love doing the hits. And now we had an album out about a year ago, so we interspersed the whole show with songs from the album. So there's always something fresh in among people. Always go away and say, yeah, you know, they played all the hits that we wanted them to play, but hey, we've never heard that one before, never heard this one before, and that's how you keep it fresh.
I saw you at your Christmas show at the O2 last year, at the O2 Indigo, and you did something very interesting where you played the first half of the show was a full album without stopping, must have been about 40 minutes. Yeah. That looked really hard work, and tell us how you put together that, because that must have been very challenging.
Well, I tell you what, I'm going to let you into a bit of a secret now. We had the actual album playing, because it was a medley album, playing quietly in our cans. Right. So we actually played along with the actual album. That's how we were able to remember it. And of course, it jogged our memory, but the sound man cleverly sort of balanced it that our live stuff was over the top of the album. And yeah, I mean, it was great because we enjoyed doing it, and a lot of people said, how did you remember all those old songs? And well, I've let the secret out now.
Great stuff. And I know when I spoke to you before, one of the things you said, actually no one had asked you before, is that when I've been to your concerts, you're the only artist I've ever seen, Chaz and Dave, who has three generations of the same family all sing along to the songs. So you'd have, like, say, the grandmother, the daughter, and the grandchild. Can you think of any similar artists when you were growing up that actually had the same kind of thing?
Only, when I was a real kid, there was used to be the Finsbury Park Empire, which was a variety theatre in North London. My mum used to take me to see acts like that, not necessarily bands, but there were people on stage that crossed all generations. I mean, I can remember seeing Peter Sellers when he was about fourth on the bill, doing an act when I was about seven. So there were a few acts that sort of across the board. But yeah, as far as a band is concerned, I think we're pretty unique that we cover all generations, and we got new kids being born all the time on Twitter. I get weekly. Oh, my 3-year-old son won't go to sleep until he's heard the Sideboard song or Rabbit or whatever. And someone picked up on that and they quoted it on Twitter that I said, and I believe it. We get kids picking up on our songs. That's the greatest compliment we can have, because kids, they don't lie. They're honest. And I knew what I liked when I was a kid. So, yeah, and they'll go on forever being fans. But, yeah, it does go right across the board, and I think we are quite unique in that respect.
Absolutely. And obviously, I think you came from quite a musical family. Was it your mother who played piano as well? Is that right?
Yeah, she was a great piano player. She was self-taught, but there was nothing. She knew all the right chords. My nan coached her, who wasn't a musician, but she didn't play any. Well, she did, actually. She played the mouth organ. But she did had no formal teaching. But she coached me mum. She knew what was right and when it was wrong. And it was me nan that got her to play the piano. And piano just is a great thing in my life, because not only does it give you pleasure with the songs that you sing and the songs that my mum used to play, and in turn that I play, and then in turn I've seen Jerry Lee Lewis and worked with Jerry Lee Lewis. But the piano also put food on the table when we were kids, because my dad died when I was three. He committed suicide. And, of course, we were left with my mum and my nan and my granddad, not a lot of money coming in. But my mum playing the piano in the pubs and clubs weekends around London. Yeah, I knew when she, you know, come home Sunday night, I knew there was going to be food on the table on Monday. It was... So the piano means so much to me in all respects.
Given those circumstances, did you find that when you went into the music industry kind of as a piano player, was your mum kind of behind that idea, or did she want you to have a proper job, in inverted commas?
No, she was 100% behind my music. She knew that I had a good ear for music when I was a real young kid. And she took quite a while. She was not a pushy mum, but she was very encouraging. And when I finally... She wanted me to play the piano first. I wasn't mad on that. I played guitar first on being influenced by Lonnie Donegan and his Skiffle group. And it was when I saw Jerry Lee Lewis in 1958 that I decided I wanted to play the piano. And then I toured with Jerry Lee. And, it was Jerry Lee, I can say, helped fulfil my mum's dream of me becoming a piano player.
That's a great compliment. And he's even playing in London at the moment, I think, with Steve.
Yes, Popper, he actually. Is. Yeah, we're going up to see him, actually, in Glasgow weekend. We were gigging on Sunday. We were in Southend, so I couldn't see him. But, yeah, I'm definitely going to go up to see him. We'll be going up to Glasgow.
Great stuff. Steve Cropper's going to be appearing on the podcast in a few weeks as well.
Yeah, so. That's right. Our old mate Albert Lee is playing as well. And I spoke to my mate and he said, Jerry Lee done a good show. And actually, Steve Cropper's not in it. James Burton's on it.
Oh.
He wasn't on it, apparently. He was billed to be on it, but he didn't. They decided that he weren't going to be on it for one reason or the other.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
James Burton came on with Albert Lee, so yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And obviously you mentioned that he was a huge influence. Talk us through how it actually went from seeing him on the stage and being influenced by him to actually then being in his band. What was that transition?
Well, when I saw him, I was in a skiffle group. I was 13, playing skiffle songs when I saw him in 1958. And I was just absolutely blown away by what he did, by his piano playing. And I remember going over that night and I thought, I found it a bit harder than picking up the guitar that I was determined to play. And that was 58 and 59. I bought a bass guitar, and it was a new instrument around North London in 1959. And I was in all the bands that going. I was earning a fortune. And, it was great because they all wanted me in their band because I played bass guitar. Then in 1960, the band was formed called The Stormers, which turned into The Outlaws in 61. And leaping on from there in 1963, we got the chance of being Jerry Lee Lewis's backing band on a tour of Britain and Europe. So that was absolutely fantastic for me. That's when I learned to play the piano, really, just being on tour with Jerry Lee.
What was your first... What can you remember from when you first met him and got to play with him? Because it must have been quite overwhelming for you in many ways, because he'd obviously been such an influence to you.
Well, yeah, I mean, not overwhelming, just an absolute thrill. I mean, I wasn't nervous or anything like that. I couldn't wait to play alongside him because I knew all his songs. And I remember Richie Blackmore, who was with the band then, and he said if it weren't for Chaz, he said, I wouldn't have known what's what. He said, when we were going up the M1 to do our first gig with him, he said Chaz was telling me all the keys that he plays in. He plays Down the Line in F and Breathless in F and a whole lot of Shaking in C. And, I coached him all the way up the M1, so he had a good idea of what to... I mean, Jerry Lee, like us now, he was not one for long rehearsals. I think we had about 60 seconds rehearsal, and that was it. And
really?
We were on stage with him.
Fascinating. Wonderful.
Yeah.
And talk us about those days, because I know before, obviously, you formed Chaz and Dave, as it's known now, you did a lot of session work. What do you remember about those times? Were they kind of challenging, or did you just love that?
Well, I mean, going back to when I very first heard of a festival in 1960, that was with a band called The Outlaws. We did a three-month stint at Butlin's Filey. I mean, that was really, really great. I mean, it really got me into wanting to play for a living. Came back and a few gaps, but the band got an audition up at Joe Meek's to back Mike Berry, and he changed the name to The Outlaws, and that was our first recording sessions in 1961. And Richie Blackmore was in the band then, who later became a member of Deep Purple. We had a couple of semi sort of top 50 hits, so we were doing all right. Apart from back in Jerry Lee Lewis, when he went home, we went on the road with Gene Vincent for about a year, and that was just great experience. I just love rock and roll, and those rock and rollers, Jerry Lee Lewis and Gene Vincent, were real rock and rollers. In amongst that, when we was over in Hamburg, I was on the same bill as Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, who was my favourite English band. And it weren't long before I came home from there, Gene Vincent went back home to America, and Cliff Bennett rang me up and said, do you want the job with the Rebel Rousers? So I was straight back in a great band playing bass for Cliff Bennett and the Rebel Rousers, where I met Mickey Burt, who became me and Dave's drummer. So it was right the way through, right to the 90s, from about 65 to about 68, I was with the Rebel Rousers. Then I lived about for a year, about 1970, I joined Edge's Hands and Feet with Albert Leon on lead. And in the meantime, I was doing sessions as well. And it was when I was in America with Ed's Hands and Feet, singing in an American accent. That's when it came to a head. I thought, I've got to start singing in my own accent. And when I came back from there, I rang up Dave. I'd known Dave for about 7 or 8 years. I said, look, I've got an idea. I said, I want to go on piano now. I said, how about me and you getting together? And I got this idea about writing songs and singing in my own accent. And he had a little think about it, and he wasn't quite sure at the beginning, but he had a think about it, and he thought it was a good idea, and we got together. So, and as they say, the rest is history.
Some people sing about Deutsche girls and girls from California. They might be all right for a night, all right, but don't trust them, I warn ya. I've been to the east and I've been out west and I've been all the world around. But I ain't seen none come anywhere near the girl from a London town. Give me a London girl every time. I've got a fine one, I've made up my mind. Give me a London girl every time. I want a London.
I'm very interested in the you use a lot of humour in your songs, Chaz and Dave songs, and obviously, you had, by the sounds of things, a very challenging kind of upbringing and difficult circumstances. Who influenced you in regards to including humour and, you know, there's a lot of wit in your songs as well. Who influenced you in that aspect?
Well, I mean, humour is a big part of life. I mean, to me, that gets you through so much in life. I mean, and I was born, I don't remember the war, but I was born in the war. Just after the war, I mean, all my family, I mean, they were just witty. They were just witty people. They would, if there was a laugh somewhere, they'd find it. And I was brought up with that. So made you feel good in times of bad, when bad things are happening. If someone come out with something funny. And so, to me, it was a very important thing. So humour and music, to me, really go together as a release from the bad things in life. So, yeah, that's why there were a lot of humorous things in our songs, things like Goethe and Rabbit, and, you know, we'd like to inject a bit of humour in it.
But even Wish I Could Write a Love Song, such a beautiful love song that you wrote.
Yeah, I mean, there are serious songs as well with love song, and I know Pleasing You is a serious song,
which is
a personal achievement. I mean, apart from the humorous songs, which, I mean, people like Don Black, I mean, he's a big Chaz and Dave fan, and he's written loads of musicals, but he's, I mean, he said to me, one of his favourite lines is at the end of Margaret, you can keep the Costa Brava and all that palaver going of Ava me, I'd rather have a date. He just loves those four rhyming lines. He said that's genius.
It's a classic song, yeah.
He picks up, you know, I mean, real people pick up on humorous things. You do get people over the years, if somebody does something a bit funny in music, it's not sort of, you said, it can't be good. I don't know where that comes from, but there's a lot of people that, I mean, even in humour in films, I mean, good humour. I always remember a quote that Jack Lemmon said. They said to him, and now he was a great actor and he could do humorous parts and serious parts. And he said, what's hardest? He said, by far, humour. Humorous is the hardest part to do. Because if you do something, you try and be funny and it don't come off, you look such a fool. Whereas you can get away with a serious part. And he's so right. If you try a humorous song and it don't come off, it comes out so twee. So it is harder to do a real funny song than a serious song.
I'm interested that you mentioned Wish I Could Write a Love Song and you saw that as quite a serious song, although it's obviously a really beautiful love song. There's still elements of humour in that, obviously, because it's for those who haven't heard the song, it's a song... from a songwriter's point of view, doesn't believe they can actually write a love song, yet you're actually obviously doing it as you're writing it. And what can you remember about writing and recording that song? Because it's a classic.
Well, I wrote it as a poem on a birthday card for my wife, one of her birthdays.
Really?
That's how it came about, and it was just in the music room, and Dave said, oh, it's your wife's birthday. He said, you've got to get your, you know, all, we both used to forget cards and things like that. You got your missus a card? I said, yeah. I said, I've got it here. I said, in fact, I've written her a little poem. And I just read it out to him, and I didn't think about it. He said, that could be a song. I said, no, it's just a poem. I said, I wish I, you know. He said, a few changes around. He said you could make a song out of that. So I'd thought of it as just a poem, and with Dave's encouragement, I changed it about a bit, and it became Wish I Could Write a Love Song.
It's a great song, and yeah, it's certainly one of my favourites. And obviously you mentioned in that song that rock and roll songs come easy. But you've then obviously done a lot of other kind of more serious ones, including Ain't No Pleasing You, probably the most famous and most celebrated Chas and Dave song. It's an absolute classic. Tell us what you remember writing about that one.
Well, that is sort of a long... Me and Dave were actually... And I've got the cassette somewhere. I think we were doing London... We were writing London Girls together. And I just had the tune. I said, hang on, Dave. Because we always recorded it on a cassette, all our rough ideas, and go back after and then listen to them. And I said, hang on a minute. I said, I just got this idea, this tune. I don't know where it's coming from. Let me put it down. And then we'll go back to write. And I think it was London Girls. And I just had that tune just came to my head. Do 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 do. And again, you know. And that's all I had. Strummed that and forgot it, went back to it, and we'd finished the album a couple of months later, and we needed another song. I said, all right, it's a song too short, needs another song. And I said to Dave, I said, I'm going to dig that tape out. I said, you remember that? And he couldn't remember the tune, and nor could I. I said, I made a start. I said, I know it was a good start. I said, I'll dig it out and see if I can do anything with it. So I did, and then I wrote a middle eight sequence to it. Still didn't have any proper words to it. And me and Dave did get together and write some words, but we weren't happy with what we'd done. And then I just kept going over it, and I, one night, not many nights after, I come up with these words. What were the words that you know today? And I showed them to Dave, and I said, these seem quite simple, but they worked, I think. And he read them, and he went, yeah, they do. He said, they're great. And I didn't realise it at the time, but after we'd finished it, it was a situation that my brother was in when he was splitting up from his wife. And it's funny, I didn't realise it at the time. I thought, I've got that idea from somewhere. But that's, I think, it related to so many blokes around the country and around the world, really, that, you know, have been in that situation where they've been impacted and think, hey, I've had enough of this. Oh, darling, I'm leaving. That's what I'm going to do. So I think that's why I had that appeal. We had a good tune to it and good lyrics. Had everything going for it. And I wrote the string part. I was pleased with the old result. And it done best ever, anything we'd ever put out.
It's an absolute classic, and you recorded an awesome version for it, a stunning version a couple of years ago for the That's What Happens album. I actually had that.
Yeah, play. That's right.
I had that play at my wedding. Actually, that's, I love that version of that song. How come you did that song again?
It was a producer, Joe Henry, American producer, and my son Nick now plays drums for us, and he was involved in that album quite a bit and conferring with Joe Henry. And Joe Henry, he knew that Nick, you know, knew what we liked, what we didn't like. And he said to Nick, he said, how do you think they'd feel about doing like a club version of Ain't No Pleasing You? And he said, I think they'd love to do it. And Nick said to me, I said, yeah. So it was like a sort of an after-hours nightclub version. And, it's sort of one of those songs you do about 2 o'clock in the morning when everybody's just having their last drinks, and it really worked.
You seem to think that everything I ever did was wrong. I should have known it all along. That darling ain't no pleasing you.
It's an amazing version. I absolutely love it. And I mean, that album was your first album in 18 years. It's my favourite album of all of yours, actually. I know that not only did you obviously do your own kind of songs on there, but you obviously is very influenced by Lonnie Donegan. Tell us, in what way did he influence you as a young person? I know one of the lines of one of the songs is you mention how you felt strumming a G chord just like Lonnie D for the first time. What influence did he have over you, and then how did you then take that into the music industry?
Well, he made me want to become a musician before anybody else, before I'd seen Jerry Lee Lewis, and before rock and roll. Rock and roll was an out when Lonnie was on the scene. And I heard him on the radio. As I say, my mum, she dearly wanted me to be a piano player. And I remember there was a piano teacher in Edmonton. We weren't very well off at all. As I say, I didn't have a dad. So she couldn't afford to send me to piano lessons. But there was a piano teacher in Edmonton who was quite well known. He actually taught Mike Smith for the Dave Clark Five, who was a good piano player. I knew him pretty well. And a few other well-known piano players. And I remember he came to see me, Mum. She used to play in a pub in Edmonton or at Edmonton Market on a Saturday afternoon. And he really liked her playing, and he knew she played by ear. And he said, I don't know what you're doing. He said, but I really like what you're doing. He said, have you got any kids? He said, I'll teach them for nothing. And she came home, I was about eight, all excited, and she said, oh, I'm just this piano player. And he said, he'll teach you for nothing. And I was sort of almost horrified. I thought, all the kids that I knew that had piano lessons could come out playing football or go fishing. I mean, one of my best mates used to say, yeah, can I out of sleep play football? No, I've got to do a piano lesson. So the thought of that, I thought, no thanks, I don't want to do that. And I know my mum was disappointed. But when I heard Lonnie Donegan bring a little while to Sylvie, I said to my mum, he plays guitar, I'd like to play the guitar. And she was over the moon that I actually expressed an interest in playing an instrument. And my Uncle Alf had an old guitar that he'd done up. He lived over Acme. And he'd done it up, sort of varnished it up and all that. And I got the train over there from Edmonton one night and picked it up. And that was the start. I couldn't make head nor tail of it, but my mum actually learned to play the guitar, and she taught it to me. She so wanted me to become a musician. And yeah, my first songs were Lonnie Donegan songs. In fact, I'm doing a skiffle night in Grantham with Vince Eager, an old singer, and I'm just going to do four Lonnie Donegan songs. This is in the town hall in Grantham next month. So yeah, excellent. It's all gone a full circle.
Excellent. And I mean, Railroad Bill, your version of that almost sounds like it's written for you and you and Dave to sing. And one song, I think it's the last song of the album, All By Myself. I think you had Hugh Laurie and Jules Holland play on that. How did that come about, and what do you remember about that session? Because it sounds a lot of fun.
What one was that? What song?
Was it the last song? Is it All By Myself?
Yeah, All By Myself. Yeah.
What do you remember about recording that session?
Just
it sounded fun.
Going back to Railroad Bill, that was the first song I ever recorded when I was in a skiffle group. When I was 13, before my voice broke, I recorded it. Somebody's got a copy of that somewhere. I'd love to hear it, because I remember I did a little yodel in it, which when I heard it back, I thought, I wish I hadn't done that. But I'd love to hear it now. Someone's got a copy of it. But that was, the first song I ever recorded. But yeah, All By Myself, me and Dave used to do that. We learned that off of Fats Domino. And we used to do that in the pubs in the East End. And it was basically Joe Henry suggested. He said, how do you feel about going back to your roots and doing some songs, you know, from when you first started? So, yeah, that one came up as well, All By Myself. So we knew that. And Hugh Laurie, we met him. Well, we met him before, but didn't realise how good he was until Warner Brothers gave the album that he was on. He's a great New Orleans-style piano player. So, yeah, we had to have him on the album. So that was great, the three of us just banging away on the New Orleans stuff.
Great stuff. And yeah, it's a brilliant album. You know, if you do any more stuff like that, that'll be a treat for everyone. Tell us, I mean, you referred to London Girls earlier. I mean, obviously, you're a very proud Londoner, and you are the identifiable sound of London, I think, in music in the last 50 years anyway. I'm interested to know, who was the sound of London, or and what was the sound of London when you were growing up?
Well, my mum, for a start, I mean, she knew so many songs, and they weren't just only London songs, but she was a Londoner, and I was born in London, and the parties, everybody I knew was a Londoner when they came round from the uncles and aunts came round, or the neighbours had a party. They were just all London songs, but as far as radio was concerned, I suppose... Sunday afternoon, Billy Cotton Band show, and that was a typical London band. But before then, and we learnt these songs from my Uncle Alf, Harry Champion, who me and Dave became big fans of, and are to this day. I mean, we discovered loads of old recordings of him in the last 20 years. Didn't know if they existed years ago. But we learned all those songs from my Uncle Alf, who used to go and see Harry Champion when he was a kid. So, yeah, the epitome of a Londoner and London music, I would say, was Harry Champion, someone who I would have loved to have met. I know he would have loved what we do, but big influence. I mean, the Sideboard song is very Harry Champion influenced. I mean, it's the sort of song that he could have sang. So, yeah, Harry Champion was top of our list as far as a London musical or variety artist was concerned.
Great stuff. And tell us about the recording session that ended up, that I think Eminem sampled.
Oh, the Eminem, yeah. That was, we were doing, when me and Dave got together in 72, I mean, I was doing a lot of sessions in the 60s with Derek Lawrence, and I was sort of pretty well known on the session circuit playing bass. When me and Dave got together, I gave up bass, and when I got a phone call, I'd say, well, I don't play bass now, but my mate does. I play guitar and piano. So quite often we get booked on, the both of us, me on piano, keyboards or guitar, and Dave on bass. But one of them was a Labby Siffrey session, an album that he was doing. And Big Jim Sullivan, who eventually was a partnership with Derek Lawrence, he ran the record label that me and Dave did our first album on, One Thing and Another album, which incidentally, just someone tweeted, it was released exactly 40 years ago this week.
Really?
It was our very first album, One Thing and Another, yeah. But, yeah, this was one of the sessions, was Labby Siffrey. And it was just one of the tracks that Jim Sullivan had, he arranged it. So it was all his arrangement. We were just playing a part. Jim said, OK, Dave, here's your part. OK, Chaz, here's your part. So that was our input, was Big Jim Sullivan's arrangement. And that was the sample that Eminem nicked off it for his hit. So Big Jim Sullivan is to be thanked for that.
I know that you opened for Led Zeppelin at the Nebworth show that they did, and I know you said that was kind of a really big deal for you, and that was one of the proudest moments of your career. Tell us about that day, and tell us, maybe you could give us advice if you're a young musician and you're playing your first really, really big gigs. What preparations would you have in the couple of hours running up to it to kind of keep calm and keep the nerves at bay?
Yeah, well, there was no nerves. I don't know where that came from. It was one of our proudest moments, because it wasn't.
Oh, okay, fine.
it was just another gig for us, the Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd just come back from America with his hands and feet and been doing festivals with like 200,000-300,000 people, so it was just another gig as far as I was concerned. And yeah, it was a very enjoyable gig, but I mean, it was nothing like later on when we did the places like Glastonbury and you know, the Albert Hall last year. But yeah, it was just another gig, really,
just another gig.
A lot of people there. You know, they'd come. We we went down okay. We went down better the week after, because the first week it was hard to get their attention, because obviously hardly anybody knew of Chas and Dave. And that with 300,000 people, it's hard to get their attention. And the week they booked us a week after. And I thought of this idea that we've written a new song with a, you know, we've done Gertrude one word thing. I said, we've written a new one, and we want it's for everybody to join in, and the song's called Bollocks. And it actually got their attention. We hadn't actually written a song about it up until then, but it actually grabbed their attention, and I thought, that's good. So after three, shout Bollocks, and they warmed to that one. So we got them there, so I had to write the song after. And the next, you know, there is a song in existence now. But yeah, it was a gig.
What
great fans of Led Zeppelin, you know, they're all right. I knew Jimmy Page in the 60s, and he's not a bad guitar player.
What's your motivation to keep writing?
It's more so the older I get. When I very first started writing, I found it pretty hard because I didn't really know anybody. My mum wrote a couple of instrumentals, but there was no real songwriters around me to I didn't know how to start, but to, you know, I thought, well, I'll just start and see what happens. But the more, when I did start, and then me and Dave, wrote Dave in on it. And then once I got into it, I found it not easy, but I started enjoying it, and that's the main thing. I wasn't enjoying it at the beginning. I was producing songs, but wasn't enjoying it. Up until, well, Dave sort of bailed out of writing a few years ago now, but I continued, and I do enjoy it now. I've got a real buzz when you finish a song. It's like having a baby. You sort of like, I mean, I watched, we got a German DVD that's come out, and it's quite good, actually. We recorded it in 1980, and I didn't realise it, but, and we did it, and I watched it, and I thought, oh, why don't we do Ain't No Pleasing You? But of course, it wasn't written then. I hadn't written it then, and it's strange to see your own self, and you think, it's like a baby that ain't born yet. That wasn't born yet, so we didn't know it. It's strange to think there was a time when there wasn't such a thing as Ain't No Pleasing You around.
What ambitions do you have left?
Well, as I say, it's like having babies is for songwriting. I mean, I'm always in the middle of a song and at the end of a song, and I've got all departments of songwriting. I keep a book. So yeah, songwriting and the more live shows I do, really enjoy it. It's part of my life. And when I mean, just the latest one was Southend 2 nights ago, like 1,500 people there, just on their feet, everybody singing Ain't No Pleasing You, for instance. They sing them all, but they really built that one out. And it gives you such a buzz. And when we done one or two new numbers, and when they go down, you think, well, this is never ending. This can go on forever. And it does, keeps you young. My mum always said music keeps you young, and it does. You stay the same. It's a bit like I remember saying cartoon characters in the paper. They never get old. They stay the same. Like just William in the William stories, he stays the same forever. And music seems to do that for you. It keeps you the same, especially when you make records. I mean, those records stay the same. So that's your quest to keep things the same, to not get older. It's like making records. So yeah, it's a way of making time stand still and not get any older.
Will your granddad
come on and go
down to mommy? Don't forget your buckets of spades and cosses and holes. Down to mommy, we'll have a fill of jelly to the cockle soul. Down to mommy, we go on the pier and we'll have a beer a sight of the sea. Down to mommy, you can keep the cost of Brahma. I'm telling you, mate, I'd rather have a day down Margaret.
What advice would you give to young people going into the music industry? You've spent 50 years in the music industry. What's the two main things that you would advise people?
Well, as far as your music is concerned, just get out and play everywhere. Learn your instrument, play everywhere. Don't care if it's a school hall, a pub, an old people's home. Just get out and play. If you want to be a performer, because that is the way to learn. You get to know what people like, what people complacent about, what gives them a buzz, what they want to sing along to. And you don't think to yourself, what would they like? Give them what you like first, and then take away. In other words, go out with 10 songs. And that's basically what we've done. We have 10 new songs, and we'll play them over the years. We've played them on stage. And if like 7 of them go down really good and the other 3, then they're sort of half and half about, then they get dropped. And then you put another 3 in. So you're giving the people what you want and they're taking from you. A lot of people sit down and they've got it wrong. They go, oh, we think we know what the people want. Well, you don't know what the people want till you go out there and actually do it. And that is your number one. The response, they'll tell you straight away. And that's number one thing for anybody who wants to be a performer and a musician. Get out there and play everywhere, and then people will see you, and then they'll start to offer you money. The other thing talked about money is when you start earning money, just keep your eye on it. I mean, there's a lot of trustworthy people, but if you ain't careful, if you don't look like you're looking after your money, then those other people think, well, they don't really want that money as much as I do. I'll have some of it. So just keep your eye on your money. Don't have to be greedy or on looking after every penny every minute of the day, but just keep your eye on it. Keep your eye on who's looking after it.
That's really, really good advice. Thanks for that. Okay, and as you know, this is a podcast we're recording, and there was a bit of a cult hero and a trailblazer in the podcast world. The first person to have over 100 million downloads of podcasts was Carl Pilkington, and I believe lifelong ambition come true, or it was on his bucket list to sing with you. Tell us about that. What was Carl like, and what was it like to work with for a day recording that?
Oh, that was great. I didn't know he was the world's biggest... It came about through, I think it was Ricky Gervais, because Ricky Gervais had him on that, he knew him first. And on that thing, he used to go around the world, didn't he, doing things?
An Idiot Abroad.
Yeah, Idiot Abroad, that's right. And we just heard through the grapevine that he's one and only big song that he wanted to sing, and he wanted to do it in Japan on the karaoke, but that didn't come around. In his all-time favourite song was Ain't No Pleasing You. So we finally got to do it, and it came through to us, and we said, oh yeah, we can fix that up. So we got a mate, funny enough, in a studio in Arlow. Funny enough, the bloke who's got it was the bloke who introduced me to Dave many years ago, Brian Juniper, my old schoolmate. He's now got a recording studio in Arlow. So we got Carl down there, must be 3 years ago now, I suppose 2 or 3 years ago, and we did it. And yeah, he was great. He just was like, we were his heroes. But we thought hell of a lot of him. He's great. I haven't seen him since, so I don't know what he's up to. But he's a one-off, Carl.
He certainly is. Great stuff. So, I mean, thanks for appearing on this, and thanks for talking so candidly about your career. Obviously, what's next? You're gigging all the way up till Christmas. I mean, I'll probably be at the London one you do that. What's planned for that one?
The Apollo?
The London kind of... I think you've got one booked. Is it your Christmas one that you do?
Yeah, but we're doing the Apollo.
It's Apollo.
Something else now. Used to be the Apollo or the Odeon.
Yeah.
Yeah, we can have all the songs. We're not sure yet, but it's going to be... we might do the song with the record again, but we'll have all our old brass players on it. They're going to be there. I mean... Known them for years, since the 60s. They played on our hits, and Ain't No Pleasing You. And no, actually, went on that one, but a the others, which I arranged. So, yeah, we're going to have all the boys on it, and it's just going to be one complete jamboree bag. Because we got a release. They're releasing all the jamboree bags on one box set for this Christmas. So that's going to be a good release, good party release. There's like four albums, and one of them is a triple album, all going out. So, yeah, we'll be doing a few songs from there as well. So it's going to be everything. It's one big jamboree bag party.
Sounds great. And do you think you'll record again? Do you think you'll go into the studio and
yeah,
record now with Dave? And
yeah, I mean, I've done a couple of solo albums in the meantime, and I'm sort of working on one now. So I'm recording all the time.
Do you think Chaz and Dave will release a new studio album in down the road, or is there no kind of ambition for that at the moment?
Well, that's what happens. It's like, I mean, to quote the title of it, it just came out. Coincidence. Phone call, you know, what comes first, the phone call, is when Warner Brothers rang up and said, we fancy doing an original Chaz and Dave album. So that's how that came about. In the meantime, I'll continue writing and doing these solo albums, and I've got enough songs for a brand new album, so we'll wait for the phone call.
Fingers crossed, because the last one was absolutely amazing. All right, well, thanks for appearing on the Stage Left podcast, Chaz. You've been the sound of London and you know, many people's lives for many, many years. So I hope you carry on and, you know...
Yeah, oh, yeah, no danger of that.
Good, good, good. All right, well, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed it.
All right, mate, yeah, I did.
All right, cheers. Thanks, Chaz.
Cheers. Thank you. 'Cause I ain't gonna be made to look a fool. You've done it once too often. What do you tag me for, oh, darling? There ain't no pleasing you. Now if you think I don't mean what I say and I'm only bluffing, you got another thing coming, I'm telling you that for nothing. Oh, darling, I'm a leaving. That's what I'm gonna do.
For more episodes featuring musicians who've worked with the likes of Fleetwood Mac, Bob Dylan, The Beatles, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, The Prodigy, Oasis, go to www.thestageleftpodcast.com, follow us on Twitter at @TheStageLeftPod, or like us on Facebook at facebook.com/TheStageLeftPodcast. See you next time.